Welcome to the Independent Thinking Show for Fifth Wrist Radio. This is a place dedicated to showcasing the great people doing interesting things in the world of horology. My name is Roman, and today I'm joined by my co-host and friend Anthony from Defining Time. Hey Anthony, how are you going?
I'm well, Roman. It's 7:37 a.m. In Adelaide, so it's a bright and early one, but this is what we love doing, so it doesn't matter to me at all.
I thought you haven't been to bed yet.
I tell you what, a funny story. My wife and I actually were on the couch at 9 o'clock and we were asleep, so we went to bed before 9:30 last night, which is just ridiculous, but these things happen. I was tired.
There you go, listeners, an exciting glimpse into the life of a podcast host. Usually we cut these things out, but, you know, we thought, you know, we'll give you a treat. Now, more excitingly, though, we have a great guest joining us today. Please welcome Asher Rapkin from Collective Horology. Hey, Asher.
Hey, guys. Hi.
Now, your name might sound familiar to some of our listeners. Asher was a guest on another podcast last year. I think the second most popular watch podcast out there, Hodinkee Radio. I mean, we're obviously number one, but you know, now you've finally cracked into the big leagues. Welcome.
Thank you, guys. It's really nice to be here. And it's entirely my fault that you had to crawl out of bed to talk to me. So I apologize massively. Thank you.
It's fine.
You can still drink, though. I won't judge you.
It's a pleasure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, we'll get to that in a sec. See, it's always bad form when our guests know our structure better than I do, so I have to remember to do that.
It just means I listen, man. It just means I listen.
I can try and introduce you, Asher, but why don't we put you on the spot early on? Why don't you introduce yourself, and then we'll take you to pieces.
Sure. My name's Asher Rapkin. I'm as we were discussing just before this got started, a bald man who is interested in watches, so much so that he's decided to take what little free time he has after work and kids to put together with his buddy, Gabe Riley, who sadly is not here, but in my heart, an organization called Collective Horology, which is a org designed to bring together both the beauty of in-person community, which we can talk about in the time of COVID, which is fun, and collaboration, where we get to work with the watchmakers that we really admire and respect to create pieces for our members.
That's very cool. And it sort of really runs along what we are trying to do on the other side of the world as well, is, you know, bring watch enthusiasts and other similarly afflicted people, you know, and give them a safe space to gather and discuss escapements and case shapes and all the other minutiae things. Yeah, so it's great, which is really lovely. Now, you're also a watch enthusiast and collector in your own right, and I think that's where you and I first met, was probably down a Instagram rabbit hole discussing a particularly obscure watch.
It wasn't Instagram. I think you and I might be one of the few people who have ever met through eBay, as I recall.
Yes, that's right. eBay.
Because normally I feel like when you say, hey, I just met someone through eBay, it's like, oh boy.
Well, it's better than Craigslist. You know, that's basic.
Yeah, exactly. You're a missed connection for me on Craigslist. No, I can't recall. I remember exactly what it was. I was raising funds for the watch I'm wearing right now. And I put a number of pieces that were super esoteric up on eBay, and I think you made me offers on damn near all of them, which was remarkable because these were pieces that I thought were just going to sit there for a while. And then you told me that you wanted me to ship them to Australia. So like, this is definitively going to screw me.
Definitely.
turns out it was quite the opposite, but I think it was a few months later that I noticed, because I was following you on Instagram just anyway, I'd come across you. In my internet travels, and I saw some of the watches that I had sold. I was like, what are the odds that this guy has exactly the watches that I just sold? And from there, we ended up on a podcast a year and a half later.
There you go. I guess that's kind of encapsulates the modern horological journeys, right? That people kind of across platform, you know, meeting places of things. Oh, that's so
interesting. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because I think we all kind of have our own collecting styles, and you know, I tend to move relatively rapidly through watches because I like to experience variety, and I can't afford to keep everything that I really really love. But usually, when I encounter people on selling platforms, it's highly transactional. But what's interesting about, you know, when you sell these sort of weird watches, and I think the watch that you bought from me was the Hoppering Messina lab.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. Yes.
Yeah, which is an awesome watch. You know, and I'm always just curious about who that person is. Because it's one thing if you like, you know, oh, I have this old Tudor. I love Tudor, but you know, you put a Tudor watch up and you get six offers and that's that. And you don't really think twice about who the individual is. But the person who's going to buy a bronze limited edition Hoppering II, I'm curious about that person. And I think those kind, you know, that can often lead to some really fun conversations down the way. Plus, also, there's not that many of those out there. So if you follow the tags, you can generally figure out who those people are down the way. And I think that sort of, to your point, concentric circles of watch collecting lets these various different groups overlap. Because you introduced me to a number of friends in the Australian community who I'd never met before that are all part of your concentric circle. You know, and I think it's neat to see some of those overlap. Like, I know you are, I believe, an admirer of my friend Rob over at Topper.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And some of his editions. So it's neat to see that too.
That's so cool. And, you know, to complete the circle here, that bronze piece Anthony has tried on as well before he moved to Adelaide.
And can we just go to wrist checks now? Because I've just got the best segue. We're here, so you might as well let me do it. Is that all right?
Oh, please.
All right, cool.
By all means.
So just in the spirit of we're talking about Habrings and the Messina Lab stuff, in the spirit of, if you have a look at Heroptimist, he's just put up a post of the new Messina Lab 02 Irwin that's got a rose gold outer section of the sector dial, and it's just absolutely stunning. So I'm in the spirit of that, and also having a look at you know, Ash's collection, that I'm wearing my Habering TZ21.
Hey.
And you can see here that in Heroptimus' post that none other than Philippe Dufour actually bought one of those bronze Messina Lab, the first edition. There's some respect out there.
Yeah, that was cool.
It's cool.
That was cool. And you know what's interesting too? Have you ever noticed there was a whole lot of hype a few months or a couple of years ago because the other watch that a relatively available watch, so to speak, that Dufour was apparently wearing somewhat with some regularity was a BLRO of all things.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know we don't tend to talk about that brand on the show.
That's all right.
It's fine. It's fine. We cut all these bits out anyway.
Roger Smith and I share a watch as well. We share the 114270 Rolex Explorer, and that's if they can wear it, then I'm cool. I can wear it. We can appreciate it.
Awesome. You're a big Hoppering fan to begin with, are you not?
Yeah, definitely am. Look, I think what drew me to them absolutely was just the fact that you can have conversations. You know, I'll never forget ringing the number on the website and Richard literally answered the phone and said, "Hello, this is Richard." And I'm like, wow.
There's an earnestness to that brand that you don't generally find elsewhere. You know, it's very honest. I love it.
Nah, they're just doing some really cool stuff. And it looks like they're really busy at the moment doing a ton of special editions, and watches are popping up left, right, and center that they've been working on for the last couple of years that are finally hitting. And yeah, the beauty is no one will ever get them because they're 10 piece editions or 20 pieces or whatever it is. So, you know, if you want one, you know, go work on one, get 10 friends together and go make something really special that will just be amazing.
Well, I'm certainly predisposed towards that, so full support on my end there.
I was going to say, hold that thought, because I'm sure we will be discussing doing these sort of things as well. So, yeah, now that's sure. Good. That's really exciting. And you know, just to put some cat among the pigeons, it probably explains why there have been a few Philippe Dufours recently hitting the auctions. You know, he was trying to raise funds for the Hoppering. That's good. Makes sense. And the BLNR, you know, he probably paid over retail. Yeah,
if only you can't buy that. If only I could just sell a couple Hoppings, go out and get myself a Simplicity. Perfect.
Well, you know, those BLNRs don't come cheap on Chrono 24. You know, you have to raise some funds. You can't buy them at retail.
Yeah, well, you know, you probably had to buy at least a couple of solid gold Rolexes to get
exactly
it.
Those platinum Datejusts, you know, just to get on the list.
Philippe Dufour, he's just like us.
Exactly. He's always wanted a Rolex, you know, couldn't find one, started making his own. And look, he's done quite well. No, he's you know, let's not throw stones at the statues of the gods. No, it's all, but you're right, Anthony. It is quite nice to see independent watchmakers actually showing respect to other independent watchmakers, in a sense. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's awesome. What about you, Asher? What's gracing your wrist?
I am wearing one of my absolute favorite, if not my favorite watch, which is the Grunefeld Principia 1941 in stainless steel with a salmon dial, movement number 6, which has essentially not left my wrist for more than a couple of days since I got it just over a year ago.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's just, and you've got a picture of it on your Instagram, and it's so good.
Yeah, I love this watch. And, you know, you were talking a lot about how the personality of the maker can often impact, or at least you were referencing that a moment ago with the Habberings can really impact your perception of the brand. And, you know, I became aware of the Grunefeld brothers a couple of years ago, but I didn't actually get to handle this watch until I was at SIHH 2019. And it's probably the largest financial decision I've ever made in.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah, right.
Picking this watch up. Because the second I got to handle this watch, you know, and spend some time looking at their incredibly distinct style of finishing, I fell madly in love. You know, and I essentially ordered one on the spot and then spent the next 7 months figuring out how the hell I was going to pay for it, which was in many increments, to be completely candid. But I don't regret it one bit. They are lovely people too. You know, and I think that they're completely self-funded. You know, they have, from what I understand, I don't believe they have any outside investors whatsoever, which is remarkable to be able to build what they've built completely on their own. And that's aside from just the incredible aesthetic.
Yeah, absolutely. And we spoke about Rob earlier on, our co-conspirator here at Geneva Blue. And I think that watch is one of his grail watches as well, because he knows the brothers quite well. And that's what he was saying is, you know, just from their personality imbues their watches with so much joy and pure happiness. And the watches themselves are insanely awesome. So no, congratulations. That's a brilliant piece. At what stage did you let the wife know that you've got a watch on order? Is it when you raised half the funds already, or she still doesn't know? She thinks it's a swatch.
She might be listening later, so maybe we just move on swiftly.
That's fine. We need some more female listenership. That's great.
Well, I can confidently say, knowing several people who have owned one and one person who's moved out of it, that they do better than what I paid for it. So that makes me feel confident.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's never going to be that many circulating at any given time. So that's the other thing. You know, if it takes them, you know, 6 months, 7 months to make a piece, and there's always going to be somebody who wants a piece now, and there's always going to be somebody, you know, that's why they sort of hold their value really well. And they are just spectacular watches on their own as well. So yeah, they're unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, what's interesting is within Collective, there are, I believe, 7 Principias.
Oh, wow.
Might be 6. So I'm fairly comfortable saying that I think we have the largest population of Principias in the world.
I'd say so.
And I think there are 2 Remontoirs, 3 Remontoirs actually, that I'm aware of, including one of the Hodinkee editions.
Cool.
I think you can really chalk that up to anyone handling one of these watches who is even the least bit informed about what goes into them becomes utterly enamored. And, you know, there's a handful of watches out there that I think for true watch lovers, you know, that they just, you cannot handle it and not feel something, you know. And I mean, a simplicity is there, a Kari Voutilainen, you know, vent date is there. They're just, you know, and I'm not talking about like things that you can necessarily acquire, but you can't hold it without feeling the hand of the maker, you know. And it's, I think the fact that this is, while it is stupendously expensive, and in no way would I ever suggest it as like a remotely affordable watch relative to its competitive set, the fact that they make it available in steel to me really tells you that they pay attention to wanting to build for enthusiasts. And, you know, I know it sounds silly to say something that costs, you know, 5 figures is like an accessible timepiece, but when you compare that to what it would be like to get a hold of a Kari, or what it's like to get a hold of, you know, many other makers at that level, it's they're utterly inaccessible. At least a Grunefeld is, you know, a couple of BLROs.
That's right. No, absolutely. No, and you're right that they are very much a enthusiasts driven brand, I think, you know, because you don't see a lot of, you know, celebrity endorsements and none of that kind of guff. It's like very much, we build a beautiful piece. The collectors or people who appreciate what we do will get it, you know, and they will become our best sort of ambassadors in that sort of sense. So I agree with you there.
They're all of the art and none of the pretension. You know, I was talking about this with my partner, Gabe, last night. We were here having, you know, socially distanced beers in my driveway. Gabe lives not too far from me in Southern California. And we were talking about this piece in particular. And part of what is so wonderful about that brand is, you know, the incredible skill and the stupendous design that they bring to the market. You know, they happen to be that perfect brand that it does, in my opinion, have excellent design chops and really phenomenal craft skills. But they do it without chasing anything. They're not chasing fame. They don't care who has it on their wrist, you know?
Mm.
And I think that in and of itself gives them a warmth and a credibility in the community that might shun things like celebrity endorsements, you know, or any other, and I say this as a professional marketer, you know, anything that is trying to persuade them. There is nothing that the Grunefeld brothers do to try to persuade you to buy their watch other than to tell you that it's magnificent and encourage you to handle it. And that's it. And that is marketing that cannot be bought or paid for, period.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also speaks to a sort of a degree of confidence they have both in their ability and in their product to say, hey, it stands on its own. If you handle it, if you see it, we think it's so good or so compelling an offering that you will not resist it, which is wonderful.
Yeah. And, you know, they are of the same cohort of a handful of independent watchmakers over, you know, that I think all came out of Vostep somewhat same few years. You know, so you have, Stepan Sarpaneva in that world too, who's another sort of perfect example of like anti-marketing.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, so much so that I think he's often trying to convince people that like the style of his watch may not actually be for them. And that's why you should check it out. You know, but what I love about that cohort, you know, which also, you know, includes, Kari and I was going to say, and to an external orbit like Max Bucer, you know, is that these are all people that are making things that come utterly from the heart. You know, they're pure expressions of the things that they want to make. They're not looking at like, what is the opportunity? Like, what is the color of the year? You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I don't think Stepan Sarpaneva could give two shits about what the color of the year is. You know,
that's right. Well, yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Yeah. He's just trying to figure, you know, he's just making for himself. And then there are and then as a result, it attracts people that are just, you know, into that incredibly unique aesthetic of his.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny you mentioned that cohort of the indie makers that kind of all came through. Yeah, because that generation included like Peter Spigmarin as well. And he came out with, you mm-hmm. know, when he was at his eponymous brand, he had his own sort of design aesthetic. But they all kind of went through that Renault and Papi workshop as well. They used to make, you know, all these highly complicated movements for everybody, you know, from Audemars Piguet to essentially everybody. And they were all working together at the same time. In the presumably must be late 90s before they all kind of dispersed, and you know the McGonagalls were there as well. They went to have their brand.
Really? I didn't know that they were part of that same crew.
Yeah, they were all working together. I think they all worked at the same time. I think Peter Spigmarin worked with the Grunefeld brothers, worked with McGonagalls, yeah, with Julia Papi, and they all kind of dispersed to do their own stuff.
That's so interesting because one of the things that pushed me over the edge after I was, you know, sweating bullets committing to buy the thing was the Naked Watchmaker podcast interview with the Grunefeld brothers and really getting into their, you know, the technicality of how they approach movement finishing, you know, because in my mind, like that's really what you're buying when you're buying, you know, a Grunefeld. You're buying an absolutely exceptional example of movement finishing. And, you know, it was interesting just to hear a conversation, you know, from that perspective, focused on such an utterly specific, you know, world, you know, area of horology. Like, you know, I think the idea of like, you know, a well-finished movement gets thrown around a lot, but like, to be completely candid with you, up until about 3 or 4 years ago, like, I don't think I really fully understood what it meant to be a well-finished movement, you know?
Mm.
Like, I just thought that I think I approached it from like pure aesthetics, you know, like, oh, that's beautiful. Like the movement is aesthetically beautiful, but I didn't really understand what it meant to actually take the time to do something like, you know, what a beveled edge really was all about, you know, and why somebody would have such a passionate desire to make the absolute perfect, or take, you know, to execute that so utterly perfectly that you know, it stands scrutiny under the most brutal of lighting and loops, and why that matters. You know, the idea of just doing something to prove it can be done.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think often what you need is you need to hold a example, you know, a superlative example of that in your hand, and then loop and go, oh, now I understand, I think, which is where I think something like a Philippe Dufour would be mind-blowing. Well, I've never handled it before, but I would imagine, having spoken to a few people who have, it's that you sort of, you look at it and go, ah, all the kind of, you know, all the dots connect, and you go, ah, that's what a perfectly decorated movement, finished, hand finished movement should look like. And you sort of, you know, you reset your, you know, levels in your mind to go, ah, good, that's the standard now.
You want to know the funny thing though? I've handled a Simplicity twice. Once back in December, there was a Platinum one that was going up for auction, and I got to see the auction preview.
Nice.
And then one when I won at an F.P. Jorn boutique, that was on the wrist of a guy there, and I like beelined to him. I was like, I don't care about these Jorns.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing that blew my mind about it, aside from, you know, for let's put the movement aside for a moment, is that when you look at the dial, the dial is almost slightly imperfect because, you know, it's all done by hand, and some of those and there's like almost a little bit of like imperfection in some of the like some just the lettering that gives it this incredible human touch that is not present in virtually everything that I've ever seen.
Yeah,
you know, like it really felt like what it was, which was something that had been made by the hand of the maker. And I think we speak so much about perfection being, you know, the be all and end all, but I think there's a little bit of a magic to there being just, you know, something that's just like a little not 100% on the dot that makes it feel more alive.
If you have a quick look sometimes at some of the Roger Smiths, if you look really carefully, a couple of the Roman numerals are just slightly off, or they've got a little bit here or something there. And you're so right. It just brings this level of the craftsman into it, that it's not perfect and it doesn't need to be perfect. But it's just amazing that, you know, these guys sit there with these tools and create these things that from afar, they're aesthetically just stunning. And even up close, the imperfections are stunning as well, because they, you know, that hand has done that. It's fascinating to see it, really. It's a good point.
Yeah. And honestly, I feel like when we think about whether it's imperfection, you know, at the hand of a master maker, or imperfections that come from the wear of a watch, I think it's kind of a bummer that we just, like, you know, as a community of like watch lovers tend to, you know, idolize the things that don't necessarily show wear. Yet we talk about how these objects are not just about, you know, telling time, but marking it. Yeah, like the watches that I love the most are worn. They're scratched. One of them's dented. You know, like they've been worn, and it breaks my heart that every time I go onto, like, you know, Rolex forums or any other selling forum, everything is mint, 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 mint. Like, well, what fun did you have with that watch, for God's sake? Yeah. You know, like what did you do with it? It breaks my heart.
Yeah, I think I made that comment on one of our very early podcasts, and I'm sure we lost some listeners because of that. But I said, you know, owning a watch and not wearing it, in my mind, it's a bit like not having sex with your wife because you want to save her for her next husband. You're like, you know, I don't want to, you know, I'd rather someone else enjoys
it. You might not have lost people for the sentiment, more the phrasing.
Possibly. But in my mind, still, it has that kind of, I have this now, but I want to wear it out because I know it's, you know, it's going to go somewhere else. I want them to enjoy it more. The most badass, you know, watch I've ever seen worn and dented to, not to crap, but to a significant degree, was I was lucky enough to handle a George Daniels pocket watch that the British Museum has in their collection. So I was lucky enough, when I was in London, I met the curator, and they brought it out to, you know, to the student room well, you could actually handle it in gloves. And that's the watch that George Daniels made for Cecil Clutton, his friend.
And he actually, you know, used
it. He wore it for like 15 years, and you could see, you know, the watch is like, it looks like a pocket watch that you can buy on eBay. You know, there's scratches are all around the winding, where the key was inserted into the winding crown. You know, the crystals are a bit scratched, and it's lovely. You know, you look at it and go like, that's an object that was not perfect because it was handmade. You could see it was definitely handmade, but you could see it was sort of loved and carried and really lived with its owner. And it was really wonderful to see that, because I kind of agree with you. You know, seeing a mint, perfect, untouched, you know, still with stickers on piece that, you know, was made lovingly by a superlative craftsman, whether it's Daniels, Roger Smith, Kari, F. Bjorn, whoever it is, Gronefeld's, whoever it is, they just lived in its box from delivery to sale, never actually gracing the wrist or never doing what it was designed to do. It's a bit sad. It's a bit sad.
Do you remember the Aston Martin picture? It was an ad, and it was a very fantastic looking model in a kitchen wearing, I think, a shirt and not much else. And the tagline was, "You know you're not the first, but do you really mind?" And I think it's just a fantastic, and this is Aston Martin. This was an ad that went out, and it went up on billboards, and very clever marketing. But it's like that with these watches. Like you get something like George Daniels that's got a few scuffs and been worn. Like that's how you want to see it, because that's what it was made for. And it's like these cars, drive the cars. Don't let them sit in the garage.
It's you know, it's funny. I thought you were going to, of course, you had a much better example, but the one I was thinking of when you said the well-worn piece is, you guys familiar with Spanish Rob on Instagram?
Yeah, of course. Yes.
Yeah. His 5711 Tiffany piece, which he wore, I think, pretty much exclusively for a decade. So it actually was, you know, scratched to hell. Looks fantastic. And, you know, I it's funny because, you know, you see everybody, you know, just pulling their sleeve down over this essentially AAA bond that they're wearing on their wrist and not actually getting much of a kick out of the fact that the damn thing's a sports watch, supposedly.
Yeah. We weren't allowed to talk about that on the podcast when he came on very early days. He said, I just don't want to talk about my 5711
because I think people
just, you know, hammered him for it. The other one is Brian Govberg of Watchbox and Govberg Watches. He's got a, I don't know the reference, but it's a complicated Nautilus, and this thing is just destroyed. And he absolutely loves it. It looks so cool.
Yeah, man. I mean, that's the thing. I remember, I think the first time I had a watch with center polished links, I was so incredibly dainty about it until I realized years later that the point of CPLs are to scratch them up so that they don't look like CPLs anymore.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you actually have then you have something that's utterly wearable, and it's truly phenomenal.
Yeah, and if you completely destroy it, they can replace parts, right? With particularly with, like, we're not talking Daniels's, but, you know, with a Nautilus, if it's really that destroyed, you could, you know, Patek will always sell you a new case. If you pay for it, you know, they'll supply. So, yeah, you're exactly right. All right, well, I might complete my wrist check now. We're 28 minutes in. Why not? Why not? I mean, no one's asked as well. I was like,
but I thought, no.
What do you have on your wrist, Roman?
Well, actually, you know, screw you guys. I've got a Casio. Keeps better time than all your ones. No. Actually, I have a Joshua Shapiro Infinity Series, my number 6. Which is lovely. So, yeah, and there's a special reason why I was wearing it. But I thought it was aligned really nicely because we all have independent watches on our wrists, which is really good. And that's what this particular podcast is really all about, is trying to promote and expand knowledge about the indies.
And you're both wearing number 6s.
Well, you guys know I'm uniquely predisposed to Mr. Shapiro.
Indeed. Well, why don't we talk about that? Because you've got one as well, don't you?
I will have one.
You will have one.
It's being made right now.
Oh, that's exciting. That's a world first.
In fact, I believe one of the dials would have touched the earth of Australia before it will make it to my wrist.
Well, yes. Well, yeah, let's just pause for a second to say this is the world's first podcast with two Joshua Shapiro owners talking to each other in space.
Hopefully not the last.
Hopefully not the last. And we had Josh on the show. I think actually the last time Anthony and I recorded a show together, we had Josh on the show. We did kind of the maker owner conversation, didn't we?
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah, and it was a perfect example of hanging out with Josh, because you can't spend time with him without without it becoming, and I mean this in truly the best way, without it becoming a horological lesson.
Yeah.
You know, he's so incredibly passionate about what he does that he won't let you walk away without a little bit more of an understanding of how he figured out the process to do what he's doing today.
Yeah, which is really, really cool. Well, look, Asher, let's dive in a little bit into the collective that you mentioned. You and Gabe co-founded this sort of the collective. Can you tell us a little bit about what it is and what you guys do behind closed doors?
Yeah, sure. So to preface, I grew up in New York City on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and Gabe grew up in New York City on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And I've known him since I was just about 12 years old. And we met in the principal's office because he got in trouble for writing a not so nice comic book about me. And such a lifelong friendship began. And, you know, over the many, many years that we've known each other, and I mean, we're very close. He officiated my wedding. You know, we've known each other forever.
Oh,
cheering up. Over the many, many years that we've known each other, you know, one of the things that have kept us connected is watches, you know, watches and music. We're both into the same music too. And even though I lived in California right after college and then moved back to New York, Gabe never came home back to New York. We always stayed connected talking about watches. And you know, we educated ourselves and we grew up in the, you know, the old forum world, you know, and that's how we started to learn about this stuff. And we got really attracted to it because there was a parallel to another community that we were part of, which was the jam band community. We were big into bands like Fish and Blues Traveler.
And now you're a Fish,
you know, these bands that had huge, huge obsessive followings and communities online that would go over the minutia of everything. And there's a definite parallel there between, you know, the horological world and the music world. And over the many, many years that we've been doing this, you know, I think we've been excited to see the tent expand, but it's been kind of a bummer to see, you know, with so many people flooding into the scene, some of the negativity and the grumpiness and the nastiness that just comes with that, that comes with the anonymity, you know, the internet. And it was really kind of a bummer for us because a lot of the conversations that we used to have where we would learn from one another in forums just became like yelling matches about, you know, who had the better, you know, better 6-digit Rolex reference, which is as much as I love and respect Rolex, is really an extraordinarily dull conversation. And we wanted, and we had noticed similar, you know, at the same time that there was this core group of folks in where we lived at the time, which was in Silicon Valley, who were huge watch fans of every, you know, of all varieties, from incredibly, you know, incredible collectors of watches like Rubel Forces, all the way to Seiko 5 mod guys, and you know, but they were connected because they had a passion and they wanted to talk about it. So we started Collective with the desire to you know, to really bring together communities of people who wanted to know each other and wanted to truly build relationships with one another and have trust again in a way that wasn't necessarily possible in the way that online communities were scaling. And we thought that the glue that could hold this together would be collaborative pieces, watches that we could make that would be available only for Collective members. And that would be the calling card, essentially, of the group. And the core of it is the community that we run. We run it off of Facebook to ensure that everybody is using their real identity. So no one's hiding behind a screen name at any time. You know, it's always Asher is talking to you, or Gabe, or whomever. And what we found when we did it was that there was just an incredible hunger for folks to join, you know, and we made it a membership only process, which I think was a difficult choice because on the one hand, you know, we don't want to make this and it, God willing, will never be an elitist organization where we're choosing members at the exclusion of people. Really what we're doing, you know, is trying to identify people that will bring something new to the community. You know, so if someone comes in and they're a huge, passionate Jorn collector and they have something really incredible to be able to share about, that doesn't mean they have to have that in their collection. It just means that they have to be passionate about it. And I'm just as excited about them as I would be if someone came in and was like out of their mind obsessed with Zin, you know? We want to find people that can educate us, that can educate the community and can contribute to it. And thus Collective was born.
That's really fascinating. So it's so reassuring that there's a real hunger for, you know, for enthusiasts to gather and actually have this sort of open exchange. Is the fact that people are on Facebook using their real identities, does that elevate, it must elevate the tone of the conversation, right, I presume?
Oh, yeah. We have house rules. You know, there are very explicit rules about how you need to conduct yourself, both at our in-person events, because we do a number of in-person events when we're not living through the end times, as well as how you need to conduct yourself, you know, online. And mostly it's, you know, it revolves around very basic things, you know, debate, but don't shut anybody down. Be respectful of other people's opinions. Do not share who is a member externally. No, you know, do not share conversations externally, because there are a few members of Collective that are in the watch industry. And, you know, I think we wanted to create a space where people who are in the industry, who are also, you know, aficionados, can also come and talk. Because the thing that is weird about this business, that as I learn about it, is like, people are very shy, generally speaking, about sharing their general, their personal points of view, especially if they're in the business. So actually having a place where you literally will be kicked out if you share that someone said something, actually has allowed some of these folks to be able to express things about even the brands that they represent and they work for that they wouldn't be able to do elsewhere. And that's been enlightening, not just for the members and for me, but I think really exciting for them to be able to participate as an enthusiast for the first time, in one person's case, for the first time in maybe 20 years.
Yeah, wow.
And that has added a level of I think, dynamism to the group that I've never seen before.
That's very cool. And is one of the rules, you know, no NATOs on date justs? Just trying to see if you just.
One guy did put a NATO on a chronometer blood. Say, what do you guys think of that? And I think that.
So an ex-member, in other words. Yeah, got it.
No. He's
there. I mean that sounds lovely, and I'm kind of, once again, I'm half jealous and half kind of taking notes, because I think that sounds, I mean, Anthony, how good does that sound?
Yeah,
it's
so cool, and I think that there's more and more of these really beautiful little creations and groups of people popping up quite a lot. Like there's a couple that I know of now that are just getting into this space. And I think, you know, watch collecting is one of those things that you do want to keep a lot of the stuff private, because, you know, it's an expensive hobby, but also people look at you differently. And, you know, I think to have a safe space to be able to go privately and have conversations that you can't generally have in the public world, especially if you're working for brands and things like that, I think it's awesome. And we should really encourage it, because it's really cool.
Well, what it also has opened up, you know, which I find really wonderful, is a safe place not only for trading and for lending watches, but also for sharing relationships between trusted folks. You know, because one of the things that I, this is like not a conversation I think a lot of people have, but like I actually have a lot of empathy for authorized dealers these days.
Oh, totally.
They are, yeah, I mean, they are up against the wall. They have no inventory to sell. I think everybody thinks that they're, you know, that they're the enemy. And, you know, the vast majority of these folks are people who've been in business for decades and have absolutely insane overhead, you know, and would love nothing more than to sell you absolutely everything that you want from them, you know. But they're also deathly terrified of brands coming down on them for selling, you know, a watch that has exceptional secondary value to an unknown customer. So when you have these vouching systems, you know, built in through these groups, it really, I think, helps revitalize some of the communities with local authorized dealers, because they can feel confident and comfortable that, you know, that the person that they're talking to is, you know, is an enthusiast and not just trying to take them for a ride to get a watch that they can make, you know, a little bit of money off of. And that in turn builds further relationships and further trust, and helps to, I think, bring things back to a local level. Because right now, you know, with coronavirus, so many of these brands are embracing e-commerce. And while that brings a lot of benefits to the manufacturers, no doubt, I think it really diminishes some of the local communities that we have, you know, that brought us up. And ADs have traditionally been at the core of that, you know? So having a way to trade relationships in a way, I think, is also a really beautiful thing that communities like this have brought together or brought out.
Yeah, definitely. And what you say is right. And there are, I mean, truth be told, there are some ADs who are much better and much more invested in developing communities. Sure. I mean, I can think of Rob Kaplan, for example, on your side of the world with Topper Jewelers. Like he's done a stellar job at that.
Oh, yeah. Rob is incredible. On a personal note, you know, he's one of my like really good friends. He's a decent person. You know, that business has been in his family for decades upon decades, and it's still run by him and his brother.
Right.
You know, but what's so cool, I think, about them is that they really, really just follow their heart on making the things that they love. You know, I feel like there's been, you know, nobody gives them credit for the fact that they were the first folks to really release an extraordinarily popular Oris Diver 65, no date,
hottest. It's the hottest watch, best edition they've ever made.
And, you know, now it's like they're all over the place. You know, Hodinkee did one, Revolution did one, but these guys really kicked that off. Yeah, same thing of with course. Zodiac. Yes. Like, Zodiacs were very, very deep cut niche watches, you know? Now, and I think in no small part due to Rob, they are massively popular again.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, so I think he's really and the reason, I think a large part of the reason why those brands have surfaced are not just his own personal passion for it, but because he's listened to the collectors in his community. And there's one collector in particular that I can think of who's massively into and a huge supporter of Zodiac and has been collecting Zodiac for years and years and years. And, you know, they designed a lot of these watches together and made something really, really special. And, you know, it's easy to make a slam dunk watch with a hot brand, you know, if you go for the right reference at the right time. These guys are looking in the other corner, and that's where I think you start seeing really interesting opportunities.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with you. As you said, I mean, I managed to track a Topper Edition Oris Diver 65 from the other side of the world because they were that good, you know, that I've actually, you know, to buy one from Australia that was made in an edition of 100 pieces. And yeah, incredible. And from all I hear, and once again, I didn't realize he was a friend of yours, but that's even more exciting. From what I've heard secondhand about Rob, like, he's just a wonderful guy, really easy to deal with, great business. Yeah, and like here, for example, on our side of the world, you know, I can think of somebody like Mike Tay of the Hourglass, hugely passionate, hugely knowledgeable, and yeah, really good for the watch community. And so I think if the future of watch retail is purely digital, purely online, I think we will lose these sort of knowledgeable networks of ADs and store owners who've invested decades and accumulated all this knowledge. You know, if they go, it'll be a big loss to the watch industry, and I hope they realize that.
Yeah, but what I think will, I mean, not to crystal ball it, but what I suspect will happen is we will see the Toppers of the world, the Hourglasses of the world, you know, really unique stores that have not just invested in community, but invested in brands, you know, and I can think of folks, you know, like Martin Pulley, for example, or Tim Jackson or Jeremy Oster, you know, or Cellini in New York, you know, these are places that invested in brands long before anybody really thought they were anything terribly remarkable. You know, I think Cellini might've been the first US retailer of Lange & Söhne, for example. And those places will survive. And I hope they do because people make an effort to go to them. You know, last time I was in Singapore, I made a real effort to go to the Malmaison because it is essentially a horological museum. And I don't think that's true about traditional, if you can call it this, like big box retailers in the watch world. And I think those are the ones that are going to have a fairly bumpy road ahead of them, quite frankly, versus some of these other stores that never really relied on volume as the means of revenue. They relied on customers that they had invested in who were going to come back again and again and again. And it wasn't because that a Daytona was dangled in front of them. You know what I mean? It was because they genuinely cared about the store and the community there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're so right about that as well. So with the collective, the platform that you guys chose was Facebook. Is there sort of a crossover with Instagram or with Slack or with any of the other platforms as well, or is it purely kind of Facebook driven?
It's funny you mentioned. We actually had initially planned to run the whole community off of Slack.
Okay. Yes. Just like Facebook.
Because there's a lot of benefit, like not to get too nerdy about it, but there's a lot of benefit there for, in terms of different channels, expandability, real-time conversation, et cetera. The big issue with Slack that we tended to find was that it either gave people work hangover, like, ugh, I spend all of my time on this at work. Why am I going to do this for fun? Or people just didn't really know how to use it, and trying to explain it was just a bridge too far. Whereas when we looked at every other platform, Facebook was the one that offered the community aspect, the real-time messaging aspect, photos, videos, et cetera, that made it logical. I think we will probably, like, the biggest request that we have from members is something that's more real-time. And I suspect we'll probably at some point migrate to Slack. We had thought about doing it on WhatsApp, but that is just very challenging to moderate communities on WhatsApp. So I think that's really the logic of it. You know, in Instagram, I mean, Instagram is interesting because I don't think of it as like a community driven platform in the same way that I think about Facebook as a community driven platform in the watch world. Like, I mean, certainly, like, you know, there are direct relationships that are made there, but you can't really bring a group of people together on Instagram except for something like an event, like Instagram Live.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Where what we wanted to be able to have were multiple conversation threads going at any given time. And I'm looking at the collective group right now, and there's about 7 or 8 active conversations that are going on right now in tandem. And there's really no other platform that I can think of, you know, maybe except for Slack that really could manage something like that. So it really was just about, like, what's the lowest common denominator, so to speak, technologically that could bring everybody together and still have real identity as a core element. That said, there are still a couple of members that don't have Facebook. And I think that's kind of the challenge, which is how we make sure to keep those people involved and part of the community.
They send a carrier pigeon to the headquarters.
Yeah, exactly. open up our new MailChimp account and start mailing people. But
there's a guy who runs with a verbal message like that guy, the original guy from the marathon. I bought a beer and just dies. No, that's all. I mean, I'm fascinated, both fascinated / jealous of kind of the community that you and Gabe have managed to build together. It's like, that sounds like a perfect kind of example of what, in my mind, a nice watch community should be, right? Is that enthusiastic people having polite, intelligent, insightful, helpful conversations with each other and expanding the knowledge of everybody. That's perfect. That's exactly what it should be.
Yeah, and I think, you know, then the other side of it, the collaboration side, is a whole other party. And, you know, that's kind of, you know, the collaborations are both when we open the doors to new members. And also, I think, when we get to celebrate the community component of it. You know, it's always a weird situation when you make something that's just available to a core group of people, because by definition, it feels exclusive. But it also, I think, tends to attract really fascinating folks that want to join, because there's generally a handful prospective members reach out, and it generally falls into two camps. It's usually one sentence of, nice watch, how do I buy it?
Yep.
Or someone who says, that's really interesting. I happen to be a huge, you know, Zenith collector, you know, and I had never seen something like this before. Can I talk to you about it? And in fact, one of our founding members was, I think, one of the largest El Primero collectors on Instagram, who had just, you know, who was just blown away by the C1 and wanted to know how the hell this happened. And so to me, the collaborations are a really exciting, you know, way to kind of expand the community and find new people that can contribute to it, who tend to be curious about, you know, what it is that we made. And that certainly happened with the Josh Shapiro watch, the P1.
Cool. Well, let's talk about the collaboration, because for those of you who don't know, let's just sort of explain how you go about it and what a collaboration with the collective is.
Sure. So we have two different series that we do, the collective series, the C series, or and the portfolio series, the P series. And we do a collective series release every year. For the P series, it'll be approximately every year. The difference between the two is that the C series is made generally at a more accessible price point and is available to every single member. So there is no having to wait up till, 1 a.m. and reload your web page to try and get it. If you're a member, you're allocated one, period. And the P series are more limited runs that are done with independent watchmakers. They tend to be at a significantly higher price point just by virtue of the maker. And as a result, we make them available just to members, but we don't necessarily have as hard a limit on how many we produce. And they tend to be, unless the maker himself or herself says to us, I only have so much capacity, which was the case with Josh, for example, who was the first piece in our portfolio series. He only had the capacity at maximum to make 10 pieces. So that was our upward limit. But we've since released two. The first piece was with Zenith, which was a 38mm El Primero, featuring their No Date caliber, which is, if you're an El Primero fan, a little bit of an unusual beast. They don't really tend to make too many No Date 38mm El Primeros, with a particularly stark design aesthetic. The idea, both Gabe and I come from advertising, so we start with a creative brief. And the brief for this was really to create a watch that was emblematic of where we were living at the time, which was Silicon Valley, and the reductive design that really defines products that come out of the valley. Thus, the C1 was born.
All right.
And there are 50 of those out there, well, 51 if you count the prototype out there in the world. And then the P1, the first piece that we did in the portfolio series was with Josh. And I think you guys may have spoken about it with him on his podcast, but that is a variant on his Infinity series where he has figured out how to engine turn meteorite.
Yeah, so cool.
And he made 10 pieces of those, and it is now currently in consideration to be a nominee for the GPHG. Just super exciting.
Yeah, it's so exciting.
So
yeah, it's awesome.
Fingers crossed. If anyone's listening here who's in the GPHG, please give it a look.
Yeah. Do what Al Capone said: vote early and vote often. Let's get that watch up there. Yeah. When Josh was a guest, he did drop heavy hints. I mean, he told me before, but I was so excited when he told me that you guys were collaborating. And for our listeners as well,
yeah,
go Google Collective Zenith piece. It will blow your mind. It's awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, it's I'm incredibly excited. And the next piece, the C2,
ooh,
is just about ready.
Ooh,
we're going to launch that.
It's very exciting. Can you tell us more, or do we have to wait with bated breath?
I'll tell you a couple things.
Wait.
it is unlike the P1 and the C1. It is, I wouldn't go so far as to say a new watch. But unlike the previous two pieces, this is not a variation of an existing piece. It is something utterly new, so to speak, from this maker. It is a sports watch, which I'm very excited about.
Ooh, cool.
It's going to be, we're going to launch it, with COVID, things are a little harder to be definitive. But our aim is to launch it in the month of October. So we're really excited about that. And we've also just recently begun the early stages of planning on the C3 and the P2.
Oh, wow.
Both of which are 2021 releases. So there's, and the thing that makes me really excited about all of these watches is how just profoundly different they are from one another. The P1 and the C1 are utterly different. And you couldn't find two different makers, than Josh Shapiro and Zenith, a division of LVMH, and then this next one aesthetically and technically is quite different from those two. So that this is part of what we want with Collective, where if you were to invest in the full flight, if you will, it would be by the end, whenever that would be, one hell of a well-rounded collection.
Cool. That sounds awesome. Any travel clocks coming up? Just asking for a friend. Sorry.
Can I ask a question? Because it's interesting that we're doing so much of these editions with Collective, and there's some other groups out there that are doing very similar things. And you're talking about the Aura 65, and there's a lot of people out there that have done limited editions. Do you think that in time, you were talking about the ADs before, that are sort of, they want nothing more than to sell you watches, and that's what they like to do. And most of those people are fantastic people. But I think we're moving into a stage of brands with limited editions. Like, if we look at Omega, for example, and there's 7,007 editions and things like that, there will always be buyers for those watches. But the community at large is looking for, the Habring or the 10 edition of this and the 10 edition of that. I think we're going to see the absolute rise across the whole globe of these editions that are going to be so hard to get. And people are coming together now just to, get a few 5-6 guys together. Let's make a watch. Let's do this. Let's design it. And it's bloody hard. But do you think that we're going to see a real rise of that into the future?
Yes, I definitely do. And I think it's worth saying a couple things about limited edition. So I think, it's funny. Out in the world, I feel like there's a lot of hate for limited editions. Ugh, my God, there's another Speedy. And I think that's driven by a couple of things. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with a limited edition, And I don't think that there's anything wrong with brands utilizing limited editions to explore different aesthetics and styles, which is fundamentally what I think I think limited editions allow a brand to do, to take risks that they may not be comfortable doing in their mainline.
Yeah.
And I think the challenge is saying, does this limited edition have a reason to exist, or is it just there as like a variant of a mainline product? And that's where things fall off for me. So for Collective, the way Gabe and I tend to think about these pieces are, what is it that we're trying to say with it, and what do we want somebody to feel? And how does the watch ultimately evoke that in a way that stays fundamentally true to the design language and the style of the maker? And if it doesn't meet that bar, we stop and we start again. And I think that that's where communities become really important in developing limited editions, because if the community generally approaches, I find, like, communities tend to approach brands or makers to make something because, one, they're passionate about the brand, but two, because they want to see something from that brand. They may not say it in so many words, but they want to feel something from that brand that they aren't feeling from the mainline. And as a result, you get a couple of things. You get watches that may never have existed before, because that wasn't necessarily the way that brand thought about, the product line to begin with. You get something that's very personal. It was really made of this idea, which is different than buying a watch that, you might have, that a designer inside the manufacturer, concocted, which doesn't mean those aren't wonderful, but it's different. You feel a different connection to it. And three, it creates a sense of camaraderie amongst everyone who owns it, and I think you see that. At least I see that. When I look on Instagram and I can see various different C1s, popping up, it's a calling card. And it really, I think, serves to bind people together in a way that, just being a fan or an owner of a brand doesn't quite do the same way. So I really hope we see more collaborations and more limited editions with purpose, and less limited editions that exist purely as variation, And I encourage people who are thinking about doing this to not just push themselves, but to really find the manufacturers that are willing to be your partner in the development of this, versus somebody who views the opportunity as a group order.
Yeah, it's such a good point. And I think with limited editions from some brands that do it just because versus... and the connection point is so true. I know myself, I have through the power of Instagram and social media, I've been able to track down roughly, I think, 13 of the 21 people that have the TZ21 with Habring. And, it's an instant conversation starter. You have an instant connection because you share that watch. And people like Eric Koo has one. And, it's just so cool that you're able to share these things. And I didn't create that, yet I love that connection. I can imagine what it's like when there's 10 people on the globe that sat, maybe not all 10 sat down, but 10 people had this creation that was designed for collective, that now they can share that together for many years to come. And it's even the ability to go to a different city or different country and that person has that watch and you go, hey, do you want to catch up and have a beer? And there's this instant connection that, you know, on what planet would you be able to do that in the past? Maybe cars, maybe someone that had a special car that came from Australia, went to America, knew someone that had the same car, you could go and catch up. But other than that, it's not because we all have an iPhone. Hey, you've got an iPhone, let's go catch up. It's different. And that's what watches are able to do. And that's why I love what you guys are doing. And, you know, I'm starting to think about where I want to fit into this place and start doing some limited editions for us here in Australia with Fifth Wrist and a few other people as well. It's amazing. It really is.
Well, first of all, that's awesome. And I think, and I really am excited to see what you make.
Yeah.
And I think part of it, you know, you hit the nail on the head with how it can be a connector. You know, there's a couple of C1s that have been sold. There's one now actually that's at a dealer and it's not on the OEM strap. And that makes me so excited and kind of giddy because I'm like, huh, all right. So I wonder how many times this has changed hands in however many months it, you know, has been in the world. Whoever had it last, you know, clearly like put their own touch on it. And it's interesting to me to see that piece, you know, make its way through the world in a way that is different than, you know, a piece that you might have sold to somebody on an individual basis where it's one of many and there's no way to individually track that watch, you know?
Yeah.
And I love that. You know, there's all this talk right now. I think Vacheron in particular has been investing in using blockchain as a means of authenticating and tracking, you know, watches as they move through their life, which, you know, you can, there's pluses and minuses to that, Lord knows, but there is a certain like romance and wonderful like element to be able to like, you know, see where it's been and who's had it and what attracted them to pick up that watch, you know, because the C1's a quirky watch. So if you're going to make the choice to buy that, presumably, you know, you might be a quirky guy too. And that makes me really curious about you.
Yeah. And I think you're right. It will also be interesting to see those watches make their way through the world because then they almost sort of stand up on their own, you know, not as like, oh, well, we bought this because there was 10 of us, you know, it was the thing we all went for. With now, when the watch goes outside of that context, it actually becomes like, it's a object. It's a very individual design on its own. And to see it kind of hop and skip through the collectors in the world, it's great. Absolutely. Super exciting.
And not one is sold below MSRP. So that makes me very happy.
So I was wondering, so when you guys do your collaborations, do you think of the brands and then approach the brands, or do they brands approach you and say, hey, we heard you're doing this cool thing with the collective. You've done one with Zenith. You've done one with Josh Shapiro. Hey, you know, we are a brand, you know, we are 250 years old. Would you be interested in doing something with us? Is it you reaching out or you being approached?
It's us reaching out primarily. So there's sort of two ways to think about this. On the one hand, when we approach, I think, larger manufacturers, you have to find people within that organization that kind of get what you're trying to do.
Sure.
You know, so it's not going to someone and saying, hey, if I was to buy 100 and some odd watches, would that be of interest to you?
Right.
That's not the right conversation. If you say there's something I really want to make and this is how I think it fits into what it is that you do, you know, and this is how we want to work with you to really partner on it. It serves as a really good litmus test because you'll determine very quickly from that conversation if the brand has an appetite for that and if they get it. You know, there's been a couple of conversations where we've had where folks have been very polite, but they're like, oh, you just want to turn the dial green, huh? We're like, no, that's really not what we want to do. You know? And it's not clicking. So I think the first is really not just identifying the brands that we're passionate about that we want to work with, but also then on a second layer, making sure that those brands, you know, are open to that kind of collaborative spirit. And I don't mean that as a dig to brands that, you know, that say no, they like, 50 to 100 watches to some brands is a big deal, and to other brands is might be a nuisance, frankly.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's about really finding that and spending the time to make sure that you're approaching the right brand. With independence, it's different. Because with Josh, it's very personal, Jay and Shapiro might be the brand, but it's all Josh,
Absolutely.
So if you're going to, approaching someone like him and saying like, I want to do something with you, it's extremely personal. And that's part of what makes it so beautiful, but it's a very different kind of relationship, And, I think approaching an independent and saying, I want to make something special, you really need to approach it from a place of extraordinary passion for what they're trying to do, because collaboration can be, if it's done by committee, can be just a miserable experience. So I think part of it is convincing those people that you want them to be a partner and that you will be an equally respectful partner in return, so that what comes out is a cohesive watch, not some sort of a Frankenwatch based on two different sides pulling.
Yeah.
And do you think that kind of broadly would coincide with marketing strategies for independent makers versus big brands, right? Because presumably the marketing strategy for a smaller independent would be more based about building a personal relationship,
yeah,
which is much harder to achieve with, if you're, hey, we are insert major brand, we make 10 million watches a year.
Well, the funny thing about relationships in this world is that there are a handful of brands that do not want to know their customers.
That's interesting. That's like,
they just don't, they want to know their distributor and they want to know their authorized dealers. And the relationship between the collector and, the brand is essentially in practicality, a relationship between the individual and their dealer. And those brands don't really need to create for community in the same way, because to your point, Roman, they're making maybe 500,000 to 1 million plus watches a year. And that's just not like, they don't pay attention to the community in that same way. Smaller brands, and this is inclusive of brands that are still owned by, large conglomerates, do actually want to know their customers very, very well. And I think some of them, suffer from perception that is inaccurate. And I'll give you an example. One of my absolute favorite brands is Alango Zone. Yep. And I think a lot of people tend to be, and I'm speaking from personal experience in this, we're very intimidated because it's an expensive watch, for a lot of people, I think, a gateway into haute horology. And generally speaking, the places where you tend to meet them are at the boutiques, which feel extremely luxurious, and upscale, or at an AD, which, who wants to close a sale with you on a 5-figure watch. And for someone just starting out, or someone who's even remotely, rational with their money, that's scary. And the funny part about that, though, is that if you go to SIHH in the afternoon at the Langa booth, it's all pretzels and beer. And seriously, and like, the brand is actually really warm and friendly and kind and open-hearted and wants, every single person I've ever met from that brand, from the top down, from the U.S. president all the way down to boutique managers, are the sweetest people. And I think those guys need community to survive. And ironically, it's the people who wear the watches, who are passionate about it, who tend to be the most successful vector for marketing for them versus, I would suspect, versus some of these larger brands, which rely so heavily on things like endorsements and celebrity
ambassadors.
Yeah, because that's a controlled way of selling an idea of a lifestyle that the watch fits into versus actually encouraging you to look at the watch for its aesthetic and artistic value and then having you fall in love with it that way.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, just historically, I think, I'm just thinking to my old Purist days, I think Lange was the first brand who actually invited the Purist Pro to Baselworld. I think they were the first brand to actually open up and actually kind of, acknowledge the bastard child that the watch forum and the internet was back in the early 90s.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Lange, when you think of it relative to a lot of its competitive set, is actually a very humble brand, which is unusual at that price point. you know, and I really love that about them, because even though their watches are extravagant, they are, they as people and they as a brand tend to be pretty curious about you as a collector, and they really want to know you individually. And I found, you know, I've owned a few Lungas over the years, and I always find that, you know, that record kind of follows me. And I don't mean that in a creepy way. It's like, oh, wow. You know, you bought a Saxonia Thin, which is the cheapest Lunga you can buy.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
And they still were incredibly open-hearted to me, you know, every time I stumble into a boutique and totally don't buy anything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I've only ever owned one Lunga as well. I owned the cheapest one that they make, was the 1815, the original 36 millimeter one. And to this day, I'm sure there'll be an Instagram post somewhere in my history or a forum post where I said that was the best made entrance model of any luxury manufacturers. You know, if you look at, you know, because it's like, if you look at a Patek, it's very easy to make a Patek amazing when the Patek costs $120,000. It's much harder to make the entry level Calatrava that exciting. Whereas the Lange 1815, I don't remember the reference, but the 36 millimeter, which they've later bumped to 39, but that's 36 millimeter was, it's like a stunning watch. Like under loop, it was a stunning, stunning watch. And I remember raving about that.
Oh, they're incredible. I mean, the only Lange I own now is an Odysseus.
Oh, of course. Yes. Very cool.
You know, and I love that watch because that it's like, I feel like that people came claws out with that because they're like, you're just trying to be another sports watch because it's blue.
An integrated bracelet. F you, yuppie.
Yeah. But actually all of that kind of fell to the wayside because if you spend just 1 minute looking at it, you realize that it is definitively Lange and that, you know, if you want to call something that's an integrated bracelet derivative, then we're, you know, I mean, then all watches are derivative of like clocks, you know?
Of pocket, yeah, that's right, exactly. Yeah. Of Harrison's, Harrison's four, H4.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Like, you bastard, you ripped off Harrison. So it's
do something original for once.
Exactly. Right. So, you know, I, to me, that's the one and done of the brand for me, because it's you know, it's my style. I never feel awkward wearing it. It represents so much of what I love about them, and it's got a unique point of view. You know, I love that about them, that they were brave enough to do that. Versus some other brands that, you know, came to market with something that definitely does feel ultra derivative because they don't feel like they're confident enough to express themselves. And even though the Odysseus, you know, I think did carry a little bit of the like, you know, oh my God, there's none of them, you can't get them kind of vibe. I think it's genuinely because they don't make a lot of them, because they don't like, they don't have the capacity. I think they make less than 5,000 watches a year. And this is one of, you know, 100 SKUs they've got. So I think for them, it's been really exciting to see them come in, you know, to do that and to make something that is so much about themselves, still from the community, because the community has wanted a sports watch from them forever, but also still, frankly, kind of humble. You know, it's incredibly expensive relative to, you know, rational prices of objects in the world, but it's not incredibly expensive relative to its competitive set. In fact, it's quite reasonably priced, and they didn't have to do that, but they did. And I think that's an example of what makes that brand so great. It's the right product at the right price, you know, with a very clear and unique point of view. And for them, that's all they need to do for the marketing versus other brands that have to try really, 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 really hard to make you think that what you're buying is special when it's anything but.
Yeah. And just reflecting on the marketing, I mean, marketing is very much your purview and, you know, the kind of outside of watches and isn't mine. I'm just trying to think of kind of the Lange and Zuna marketing. I can't think of an ad that they've made, you know, like it needs to be that the brand is sort of fairly niche still even now, that part of a conglomerate, but it seems like they're being sort of left alone to kind of just do amazing watches and kind of.
Well, it's because a lot of their marketing, you know, and I think this is true about other brands that are very, you know, very community driven, like Audemars Piguet, for example. A lot of their marketing is spent cultivating small communities of people who are excited about, curious about, or existing customers of them. You know, so, I mean, granted, AP does do, you know, larger sponsorships and things of that nature. But like, they're another example of when you spend time with just them as like an entity, like they're lovely people and they're incredibly passionate about what it is that they're making. And they really, really, really want to know their collectors. They honest to God do. And that really has a benefit because over time, you start to get exposed, as you do with Langa, and I think as you do with AP, to to really understand the history that goes into that brand. Because AP, not this is a whole other conversation, but AP, I think, you know, people think about AP, they think Royal Oak, but in reality, prior to the 1950s, I think the vast majority of APs that were made were all one-offs.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, very small runs of, yeah, two or three or five.
Yeah, yeah, and the incredible, like, the incredible just unique point of view that that brand brings to the world is eclipsed by, you know, the one reference that everybody pays attention to. But the more you build a relationship with them and the more they want to build a relationship with you, the more you get exposed to the history of it. And sure, of course, they're a for-profit entity. They want to sell you watches, but, you know, I think they also want you more than anything to understand what it is that they're all about, and hope from that, you know, you'll be persuaded to continue to invest in them. But that, I think, is the difference between being a customer and being a patron, you know. And I think part of what's so great about independent watchmaking is that, you know, you're both. You know, you're both putting your money where your mouth is and supporting a, you know, a maker and doing the thing that they want to do, and getting a piece of art that's truly special. And while I wouldn't put, you know, I wouldn't put some of these brands in the same sentence, I think when you start to understand how a brand got to a place, you know, you start to appreciate the product a lot more. And that's where things get really exciting. And that is the best kind of marketing. Certainly more exciting than sponsoring, you know, a sporting event.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. So in your opinion, what do you think is the best way, you know, moving forward, what do you think is the best way brands, we're not talking about indies, for example, now, but brands can engage with their consumers? Is it social media? Is it events driven? Like, as a marketer, a professional marketer, where do you think the future lies?
I think it all revolves around earnestness. I mean, I don't think that there's a blanket answer, but I can tell you, you know, in the context of Collective, you know, we've done both physical and virtual events with brands where, you know, we drop the pretense. You know, we're not doing fancy dinners at expensive restaurants. You know, we're doing unique, we're doing event. In fact, one event that we were going to do was going to be at a, was going to be talking about the art of craft at a brewery in San Francisco, where we had,
nice.
Yeah, where we had, we were going to have the, you know, a brewmaster and a head of complications speak about their unique perspective on craft.
That's cool. And that's awesome.
Yeah. And I think when you start going down that road, what falls away is, like, you know, all of the trappings of the brand, and what's left is just the passion for what they make, you know, because nobody cares if the beer bottle, I mean, sure, the beer bottle looks cool. That's great. But in the end, if it's crappy beer, you're never going to drink it again. You know? and I think, yeah. And I think with watches, it's like after the sheen, you know, after the excitement in the bottle, you know, the cheap glass of champagne at the AD and the this, that, and the other thing, in the end, what really is going to keep you in that watch is, you know, how deeply connected you are to not only the maker and the brand, but also, you know, the thought, the process, and the history that brought the brand to that watch. And I think if, yeah, you know, the more brands can focus on connecting those things, whether it's through physical events or digital events or content, for example, you know, the more I think they'll succeed in creating evangelists, as corny a word as that is, you know, for their brand, people who will really defend and love it. Like Grand Seiko is a great example of this. If you're a Grand Seiko owner, boy, you're going to do everything you can to infect somebody else with Grand Seiko-itis, you know?
Yes.
It's because people are so utterly passionate about it, and they're so into the story of that brand. And like, Grand Seiko doesn't need to sponsor anything. Grand Seiko just needs to keep bringing watchmakers to the United States that show you what it means to do Zeratsu polishing. That will sell more watches, you know, more so than sponsoring, you know, event X, Y, or Z. So I think it's that earnestness that you need to figure out. The trick, the hard part, is how to scale that.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's kind of, what's really interesting is one of the reasons, like, kind of why you and I kind of became buddies from our eBay transactional days to Instagram, whatever, is that we're both, well, hopefully we both bring that earnestness about the variety of brands that we own, and kind of, you know, we get equally excited for each other's acquisitions or just news that come out. And your passion really shines through even in this conversation. You know, we started with, you know, the Grunenfeld Brothers Principia, and then, you know, your level of excitement was really high. And then we're talking about the Langer, which is a much more mainstream brand, but you know, you still bring out, you're still excited about the authenticity that larger brand brings to the table as well. So it's really cool how it's just all really synergistic.
Yeah. And that's ultimately, that is what I hope we can figure out as we continue to grow Collective, you know, how we can use it as a vector for people to build, I hate saying the word build a relationship with a brand because it's so loaded from crappy experiences at ADs where it implies you have to buy something, you know, but that we need to detox that. We need to break it out of that where it's okay to be passionate about a brand that you might not be able to invest in for a decade or maybe even ever, because even if you are passionate about it, you can be a patron of that brand by telling other people about it. And the more that we can use communities like a Collective, like a Fifth Wrist, to be able to empower people to feel like they can have a relationship with that brand. Mm. See, my dog agrees. The more we can, I think, develop meaningful and non-toxic relationships, you know, and break out of this idea that the only way to be connected is by spending money.
Yeah. It sounds like your dog's doing the Academy Awards, you know, wrapping up speech. You know, that's like the music. You know? it's enough now. You know, you made your point. Come on, wrap up. Yeah.
Well, what can I say? Hank has a lot to tell.
So what's next for the Collective? So how do we get people?
Yeah.
How do people find you? How do people join? Or, you know.
Sure. You can follow us on Instagram at Collective Horology. You can also find us online at collectivehorology.com. And we will be opening up membership off the back of the C2, which, as I said, is going to come out in the fourth quarter of this year. And we have a new membership process, which I think will make everybody happier. We have a group of folks who are existing members. It's a simple application, and then the existing members are going to review those and extend invitations on top of that. So it's really the community choosing how the community wants to grow. So that's awesome. And that will happen later this year. And then next year, as I mentioned, the C3 is something that we are stupendously excited about, with a brand that we're absolutely in love with, both Gabe and I. So that's really exciting. And then the P2 is in even the pre-design days, but it's with a brand that I am absolutely I idolize the watchmaker behind it, and or watchmakers behind it, I should say. And if that can happen, I will be the first in line to liquidate some assets to get it.
Awesome. Yeah. Call me. We've got history.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
But yeah, we're excited. And hopefully once all this mess is over, I can come down and see you guys, because I love it down in Australia, and I was supposed to be there a couple of weeks ago. So hopefully 2021 will be a happier time, and we can do this over actual beers.
That would be
definitely
awesome.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a plan, and we'll definitely get you back once your next project launches. I'm definitely going to be wanting to talk to you about it, because I've had a sneak preview, and it's going to blow people's minds. It's awesome. It is awesome.
I'm glad you like it. And you saw it with some things that needed to change. So,
well, there you go. Well, that's going to be even better. That's really, really exciting. So, and from my perspective, like, having this conversation with you is really inspiring hopefully for Anthony and I to see if we can build something, you know, along similar lines around Australia. Cause I think there is a thirst locally for something, you know, for this sort of community based thing. That would be really, really cool.
Yeah, definitely. I did just want to ask one question about knives, because I know that you're a knife guy. So at the moment, I'm like, I have a lot of knives, but I've not really got to a custom piece yet, and I really don't want to spend $2,500 or $3,000. So I did want to ask, with Damascus and some US made and not real high quality, but can you recommend any brands that I can have a look at, or any craftsmen that I can look at and start a conversation with to commission a piece?
I don't know if you would take a commission at the moment, but in terms of the best that you can get in the custom world, and he does, I know, work with Damascus here in the US, I would recommend Craig Brown. He has a number of knife models, but the two that he has in production right now, one is a front flipper The other is a more classic tab flipper. The front flipper is absolutely magnificent. I have one in with carbon fiber scales, and I think they're not stupendously expensive relative to Knife World, but they are expensive by normal standards. They're in the sort of $800
range. Yeah, that's all right. That's good.
But yeah, not terrifying for a custom knife. And he drops them about every other week or so. So you have to sign up for his mailing list.
Sweet.
And it's very much in the ilk of I don't know if you're familiar with the Holt Blade Works and their absolutely legendary Spectre. You know, that knife is kind of one of my absolute favorite knives for a million different reasons, not the least of which, not unlike watches, because the makers are just incredibly sweet people. But I would say in terms of knives that you can actually get that aren't crazy expensive and that you don't have to chase on the secondary market, I would recommend getting a Craig Brown.
Cool. All right. Thank you. I'll go check that out. There are a few listeners that like knives, so I know that people will go have a look. So I think I just found it. So it's brown.knives is the Instagram.
Yeah, we'll put a link in the show notes as well. So
awesome. Yeah, he's fantastic. And there's a number of collective members who also are big on him. So
cool. Thank you.
No, thank you guys. This was a lot of fun. I really appreciate it.
No, that's awesome. And just to say, you know, I'm so grateful. I'm not into knives. It's one obsession I don't need to have, so it's good. You know, I can stay focused on art, books, and watches. Yeah, that'll be enough, you know.
Join us.
Yeah, join us.
No, must resist. Resistance crumbling. It's fine. All righty. Well, so we do part of our usual shtick as well. We do, we sort of do people to follow or things to discover, both for ourselves and for our listeners to kind of grow their knowledge and interest base. So maybe, Anthony, we'll start with you. Anyone exciting?
Yeah, I got a really cool one today, which is, they're all cool. I shouldn't say that. They're all cool. Watches and words. So all one word, no dots, no underscores, just watches and words. It's a black and white scale profile that has some really interesting watches and a bit of literature.
Yeah, cool.
And it's just a really cool profile to follow. There's some beautiful lungers in there. There's some pocket watches, interesting stuff.
So yeah, there's Kodoki as well. Yeah, no, and yeah. Goldfell, Viani. No, unbelievable. Awesome. That's a good one.
Very, very interesting. Nice. I wouldn't mind having a chat with him. I think some interesting stuff there. So yeah, watches and words, go give that a follow.
Brilliant. What about you, Asher?
I would recommend, if folks don't follow my friend David, who goes by Beveled Bridge on Instagram. not only has he got an incredible eye and is a huge supporter of independence, he works as a professional dealer himself, but is a huge fan and collector. I believe he actually just got his Grail, Your Work 103.
Oh yeah, wow!
But also happens to just be a really lovely person. So you're not only are you going to pick up on some really incredible independence. If you have a chat with him, you'll discover he's a real sweetheart.
And that Moser.
So if you ever find yourself in Cologne, Germany,
that Moser pioneer Tourbillon. Oh.
Yeah.
So cool.
Well, I often he's usually one step ahead of me. Where if I find something I'm like, thinking about, he's beaten me to it.
Yeah, it's a great account. Yeah. No, we're following him already, but no, that's a good one for people to discover. The one I've got today is both a really cool indie watchmaker and also holds probably the record for the longest and most inappropriately, unnecessarily long Instagram handle, which is at Thomas. Pressure Haute Horlogerie, one word. I'm not going to spell that because it'll take me longer to spell than the rest of this podcast. So it's Thomas Pressure Haute Horlogerie. And Thomas is like an incredible maker. You know, the guy who made a triple axis tourbillon, double axis tourbillon, single axis tourbillon. Like he's just off the scale. Definitely worth a follow if you're not familiar with him. He's sort of that sort of slightly older generation of indies that possibly is less well known than the current crop of.
I remember a few years ago discovering him and then saw the Desiderata with the Zenith movement.
It's crazy stuff.
He makes some amazing watches.
Yeah, crazy stuff, like technical genius sort of thing. So, yeah, well worth discovering. All righty. Well, I think we'll leave it there while people are still tuned in. So thank you for joining us today. And many thanks, of course, to Asher.
Oh, thank you for having me.
For speaking with us. Great conversation. So thanks, Asher. Lovely having you on.
Appreciate it, guys.
That's brilliant. And the last little bit that we always say is, you know, finally, Fifth Wrist, we set it up as a platform by enthusiasts and for enthusiasts. If you want to join us, contribute, write reviews, or even come on the podcast, you know, please get in touch. We'd love to hear from people. Follow Fifth Wrist on Facebook and Instagram or on our website at fifthwrist.com. Like and subscribe to the podcast. Leave us a review. Follow me. I'm at Times Roman AU. Anthony's at Defining Time. And our guest, Asher, is at Collective Horology. Thanks for joining us, and as we always say, stay on time.